Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Today's guest is Dr. William Davis, author of the best-selling book series Wheat Belly, and he's got a new book entitled Wheat Belly Total Health. You know, I must confess that when I first heard about this, I just thought it was kind of a gimmick, a new diet book. And of course, you recognize that you know, if you get rid of wheat and you get rid of carbs, you're going to lose weight. But there's so much more to this because Dr. Davis is a serious scientist and scholar and understands the many ramifications of the effects of gluten and grains on numerous bodily systems, on the brain, on the heart, on the metabolism. You know, the effects are very, very pervasive. And we discussed them in part one. But in part two, I want to talk about some of the practical aspects of this. So the first question I'm going to put to you, Dr. Davis, is this diet for everyone? People will say, well, you know, I'm not sick. I think I'm doing pretty good. Do you recommend that everyone go on a totally grain-free diet to achieve optimal health?
Absolutely. I think all these issues apply to everybody. The odd thing, of course, it applies to different people in different ways. And so while some people may experience it as celiac disease, a minority, some will experience it as losing balance and wetting yourself at age 52, cerebellar ataxia, that is the destruction of the cerebellum in people without celiac disease, that is only partially reversible, by the way. Some people experience it as weight gain and diabetes. Some people experience it as cataracts or hypertension. Others experience it as asthma or depression or paranoia or anxiety or irritable bowel syndrome, bowel urgency or acid reflux. In other words, we're talking about conditions that affect everybody. And I also remind people that just because even if you feel well, you are experiencing effects from consuming grains. Because as you well know, you can develop an autoimmune disease and have no warning whatsoever until you have swollen joints or your liver's failing from autoimmune hepatitis. So in other words, just feeling good doesn't even mean that you're somehow impervious to the effects of grains. Now, I'm sure there are people, just as we all know somebody who got to age 85 smoking a pack of cigarettes a day, there are people who survive despite the onslaught of grain effects, but the majority of us do not. The problem
right.
is people don't see these problems as grain-related. They don't see the cataracts at age 54 as a grain problem. They don't see the dandruff they've had for years as a grain problem. They don't perceive the low back pain or knee pain as a grain problem, but many times it is.
So, and perhaps it's that some people are more genetically susceptible to this. You know, I have a theory that maybe some populations had a longer exposure to grains. Maybe there was some evolutionary adaptation to grains that occurred over perhaps a few thousand years, incomplete, but at least partial. But a population like the Nordics, you know, the Scandinavians, until, you know, perhaps the Middle Ages, they basically consumed fish and wild game and vegetation, but they didn't make flour products or grow their own wheat. That was introduced only later, and their gastrointestinal systems and their metabolisms have had only a few scant centuries to get used to it.
Excellent point. You know, there are a handful, just a handful of adaptations that humans have made over the last several thousand years to try to accommodate to the adverse effects of grains. For instance, the anthropologists tell us that hemochromatosis, that is this genetic variant that's in about 6-7% of people of Northern European descent, appeared 6,000 years ago as a means of dealing with the iron blocking absorption effect of grains. There's a thing called phytates in grains that block iron absorption by up to 90%, which can be very, very bad, of course. And the appearance of the mutation for hemochromatosis, in which people overabsorb iron, was an effort to compensate. Now, that's only one. There's a handful of others, but there's not a gene to accommodate to the thousands of components in grains. Maybe in a few hundred thousand years, we'll be fully adapted to consuming the seeds of grass, but that ain't coming for a long, long time.
Right. Evolution is a very slow process. It doesn't occur over mere, decades or centuries. It really takes tens of thousands of years for evolutionary changes to occur. Practically speaking, what's left to eat? You know, a lot of people can say, wait a minute, I cannot conceive of life without grains. I got to have grains. So what's your response to that?
Well, you know, along with rejecting this notion of eat more healthy whole grains. I also reject the notion of cut your fat and cut your saturated fat. I say that science is skimpy, perhaps non-existent, certainly misrepresented, misinterpreted. And so I tell people, if you're going to eat meat, go buy a fatty cut, you know, preferably from a good, reliable source, not a factory farm, of course. Uses antibiotics and other things. But eat the meat, eat the fat, don't trim it off, ask for some of the liver. Go back to the way grandma did it. Eat some of the organs, save the bones, boil them for soup or stock, don't skim off the gelatin or the fat. Eat vegetables, of course, nuts, seeds, not of grasses, but of sunflower, sesame, chia, those are wonderful. Mushrooms, of course, avocados, there's plenty of food. We're left with all the foods that humans used to eat before we turned in desperation to the seeds of grasses. And another thing that happens that simplifies this to many people's surprise is when you, of course, get rid of the gliadin-derived opiates from wheat and similar opioid-type compounds like the fecalin from rye and the hordein of barley and the zein of corn, appetite drops dramatically. And people say, you know what, I had breakfast at 7 and it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I skipped lunch and I guess I could have something for dinner, which of course is completely different in contrast to the people who are grain eaters, who have breakfast at 7, hungry at 9, hungry at 11, counting the minutes to lunch, hungry at 2, have dinner, start eating again after dinner. This incessant appetite is a grain effect.
You're so precisely echoing the sentiments of Jimmy Moore, who I recently interviewed about living La Vida Low Carb. That's what he says. I mean, this is a guy who weighed over 400 pounds. He's lost, over half his body weight. And he says that he's actually become rather diffident to, the three-meal, snacks in between approach because his appetite is well under control. He can have one relatively substantial meal per day, and he can go for many hours without eating.
You know, Jimmy, a good friend of mine, is a terrific example of what people can accomplish on their own. You know, we're in this new age where people have access to the internet. And they read the same information that you and I read, and they have this increasingly. Jimmy's checking his ketones by a finger stick, and you know, people are taking on these new technologies, health apps, self. I love this that people are starting to find their own self empowering pathways.
Indeed. He's a proponent of the ketogenic diet, and his new book is Keto Clarity, and I interviewed him a couple of weeks ago, so that's a good companion volume to Wheat Belly. So coming back to the specific ailments that seem to respond to this, you devote quite some time in your book to thyroid problems. Now, how in the heck could thyroid problems be related to the consumption of grain? And they're so pervasive, virtually one quarter of women have them, perhaps 8 to 10% of men have thyroid problems. It's a big deal, but why should so many people have thyroid problems? You think it's linked to diet?
Well, about 50% of people who have Hashimoto's thyroiditis, for instance, that is the autoimmune destruction of the thyroid gland, have positive antibodies to the gliadin protein of wheat, presumptively suggesting that, as is the case in many other autoimmune diseases, the gliadin protein of wheat and related proteins in other grains initiate the process. So when people get rid of wheat, and even better, other grains that cross-react, Hashimoto's thyroiditis becomes quiescent. You can watch the antibodies actually drop in levels. What the sad part of this is, just because the autoimmune inflammation subsides, doesn't mean you'll recover thyroid function. So lots and lots of these people are left. Yeah.
Yeah, actually, I had precisely this conversation with a woman who came to see me, and she has hypothyroidism, and she has very high antibodies. And she came to me because she wanted me to fix her thyroid, and she absolutely didn't want to take medication. So I said, look, the analogy I gave her is, well, let's say there's a forest fire, and it turns out that we identify and capture the arsonist who's setting the fire. Does that mean that the fire goes out? And the answer, of course, is no. The fire has a momentum of its own. And yes, without the arsonist on the loose, we won't be pouring gasoline on the fire, but there may be some permanent organ damage that's irreversible, and you may still require some thyroid medication, perhaps less, and you'll feel better. but it may be too late to completely save the thyroid. I think that's what you're suggesting.
Excellent analogy. I'm going to use that myself. Thank you.
She just was so upset that she might have to have a lifetime dependency on medication. I was trying to educate her to the fact that the thyroid replacement is going to make her feel better, but she was dismayed that, you know, she was going to actually have to use a prescription drug. But what can you do?
I think it'd be wrong if I suggest that all thyroid problems are caused by grains. Of course, that's not true. A lot of them are, but we have other things that
chemical exposure and so on. There's obviously a chemical connection sometimes to thyroid problems. So so wide variety of health problems can resolve. All right, so what's for breakfast? Because hey, you know, sometimes I like to have some pancakes for breakfast, but hey, you know, all the pancake flours, even the gluten-free flours. You're not suggesting that people use rice flour, buckwheat flour. So how do you make a pancake for breakfast? I mean, come on, give a guy a break. Gotta have a pancake now and then, right?
I'm glad you raised that issue because people often hear the wheat belly message as a gluten-free message. And
right.
It's definitely not that, as you know.
Right, because there's a profusion of products out there. I mean, it's the latest trend. You know, you go to all the natural food stores, even the supermarkets, you've got a whole grain-free aisle. You can knock yourself out with cookies and cakes and, you know, all manner of chips and cereals and you name it, and breads, gluten-free.
Conversation with an executive, very high level executive in a major food company, and I had to sign a non-disclosure agreement, so I can't tell you who it is.
Yeah.
But he said to me, he said, you know, we've tripled gluten-free sales in the last year.
It's the new low fat. You know, it used to be in the 70s and 80s, it was low. Everything was low fat. You know, slap a low fat label on it, and it was like you're good to go. Now it's gluten free, and it's everybody thinks,
right.
Hey, that's like the supreme accolade of health.
He admitted to me that even though they're enjoying the fruits of the tripling of their sales, he said, but you know what? We all know, all us high level executives and big, we all know it's crap.
Yeah.
What do we do? Turn our heads away from this astounding opportunity?
Yeah.
So that they know that gluten-free foods made with cornstarch, tapioca starch, potato flour, and rice flour are horrible. Yet they sell it because it feeds into this misperception. So you make an excellent point that I had to deal with patients years ago when they said, well, you know, this is all well and fine following a diet of, you know, of real foods, but yeah, I've got children and I've got grandkids. How about holidays and entertaining? So I came up with ways to recreate pancakes and cheesecake and coffee cake and pizza crust and just about all the things that people have come accustomed to that are grain-based, but I recreated them without wheat, without other grains, certainly without gluten-free junk carbohydrates, and without added sugar. And you know what? You can have a delicious stack of pancakes or cheesecake or coffee cake, but you're going to have to choose your ingredients carefully. It's in all the cookbooks. It's on the Wheat Belly blog. We're always sharing recipes on the Wheat Belly Facebook page. So there's lots and lots of things you can recreate. So Thanksgiving is coming.
Yeah. What's the stuffing? What kind of stuffing are you going to put in that turkey?
I don't stuff the turkey because it's very difficult to get a sufficiently high temperature within the belly of the turkey. So we use it as a dressing. We make it separate.
Okay, right. That's good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just use a cauliflower base. I like to use mushrooms in it, lots of herbs, and you can make a delicious dressing. Gravy is very easy to make. There's a number of healthy thickeners. My preferred one is coconut flour. It's very easy.
Excellent. Yeah. And coconut is on the list, and coconut being something that has a lot of fiber, but it's got healthy fats in it and is a very therapeutic food.
We can make cranberry sauce and pumpkin pie. So my last several Thanksgivings without wheat, without sugar, have been wonderful, delicious. And even the people who still eat grains in my family, the ones who visit for the holidays, are astounded. They have wonderful experiences, and they don't gain an ounce of weight through the holidays.
So what sort of anecdotes are you getting? Because you have a devoted following, and there's actually a community if you go to your blog. Could you mention that site? Because it's sort of it's a community of people who are engaged in this process. And we see astounding results before and after pictures, but, you know, give us an illustration of how people can turn it around.
Yeah, there's wonderful, wonderful stuff on this wheatbellyblog.com and in the Wheatbelly Facebook page. On the Facebook page specifically, people will post their before and afters. They could be full body. They're often just facial pictures, and sometimes they're as soon as a week or 2 weeks or a month, 3 months or longer, and you'll see astounding changes. So, yes, there's weight loss, but there's also changes in facial contour and loss of eye puffiness and loss of the redness, the seborrheic rashes along the sides of the nose. And people look different. They look, what's entertaining about this is people look so different that I'm often accused of hunting down many, many people who look alike. One is unhealthy and overweight, and the other one's slender and healthy. And then putting them up side by side and calling them before and after. Of course, no, these aren't
just cherry picked examples, you know, like one in a thousand. They're actually fairly typical.
That's right. It happens every day. So you and I don't have time to go hunt people down to look alike. So these are real, but because they're so dramatic, the changes are so dramatic, we often have to deal with these accusations of hunting down similar looking people.
You know, one of the themes that you pick up in your new book, because your new book, I think, is sort of a elaboration of your original theories that were presented in simple form in the first books. This book is a more of a troubleshooting book. And one of the aspects of troubleshooting is people complain that, well, you know, they want to lose weight, but their weight plateaus. They lose a certain amount of weight and then they feel stuck. Is there any particular reasons for that? And is there a way to overcome that?
Yeah, well, one you already pointed out, and that is thyroid dysfunction is wildly out of control. Lots of people have thyroid problems, and it could be in the form of a high TSH, it could be in the form of a low free T3, which is, as you know, very neglected. But there's lots of other problems, a lot of common drugs, particularly for hypertension, block weight loss. Beta blockers like metoprolol and atenolol block weight loss, a lot of anti-inflammatory drugs block weight loss. If you're a diabetic on insulin, that prevents weight loss. In fact, causes extravagant weight gain. So a lot of drugs will booby trap your efforts to lose weight. Dairy sensitivities, especially to the insulin provoking effect of the whey fraction of protein. This seems to be an effect in about 1 out of 5 people. And the way to tell that is people just stop dairy. I suggest a 4-week trial period. If you stop all dairy and you drop, say, 9 pounds, then that effect of the whey protein on your pancreas applies to you. If nothing happens, it probably doesn't apply to you. And there's a long list of less common reasons for people to fail at weight loss. In my experience, it's an uncommon person who, through a systematic checking off of a list of factors that can block weight loss, cannot finally find the solution.
Wow. So some great information in your new book, Wheat Belly Total Health. So our Intelligent Medicine call to action for today is, get the book. The book is available from the usual sources. Also, there are recipes, I think, in the book, but you actually have a specific recipe book, a separate book, which is entitled what?
There's a Wheat Belly cookbook and a Wheat Belly 30-minute cookbook.
Okay, great. So those are resources. And then once again, mention the blog, please.
Wheatbellyblog.com.
Also, you can like Dr. Davis on his Facebook page, and there's a constant stream of information that you can find there. So just look him up on Facebook. And, of course, you're also on Twitter because you're a social media kind of guy.
That's our age, isn't it?
Absolutely, and you're getting the word out. So, you're doing yeoman service in the furtherance of people's health. And, you know, you're old enough to remember, I think this dates us possibly, there was a politician named Barry Goldwater, and he lost an election. He lost badly, landslide, to Lyndon Johnson. And he had a saying, extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. So regardless of what you think of politics, another way to paraphrase that is extremism in the defense of health is no vice. This diet, no question, is extreme. It's a real departure from business as usual for a lot of people, but it can be extraordinarily therapeutic. I found it extremely helpful. I found it personally beneficial to pursue a diet that is, you know, quasi no no grain. But it, for people who have challenging health issues, this absolutely can be life-changing. So I commend you for getting the word out, also in communicating it in a way that really grabs people's attention, and you really transmit some of these esoteric ideas in a form that's readily understandable.
That was so well said. I wish I said it.
Well, guess what? You know, this is a podcast, so you can go back to the podcast, and you can quote me for your next book jacket if you like.
Right, fair enough.
Good job. Okay, so thank you very much. Thank you for gracing our airwaves, because you're a popular guy and you're a little hard to track down, and it's really been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Dr. William Davis, author of Wheat Belly. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.